snapped his fingers for Walter to make note of it. He'd been road testing his concepts. If these men engaged with an idea and seconded it by offering up examples from their own lives, Talbot had known it was valid for a wider audience, and it looked to Walter to put it into the upcoming book. Talbot had explained that while Adolf Hitler had been a prisoner in Landsberg prison, his cell had been the site of a constant party. People brought beer and food. Visitors crowded the room while Hitler regaled them with his ideas. The ideas that resonated, that made Hitler's listeners smile in recognition. Hitler collected those ideas into his first draft of Mein Kampf. These ideas would engage the largest number of people. And so Talbot had conducted a similar back-and-forth dialogue with the men who made their pilgrimage to consult him. These men, Clem and Naylor and Bing, he told them, "In the future, everyone will be shot for 15 minutes. Rufus and LJ, he told them, "Only the left ear, please." Walter's new old man, he'd explained that the best feedback would be a grunt, a snort, a moan, any noise to prove he'd hit a nerve with some truth. The best feedback was never filtered through language. At most, it might be an amen, or fuck yeah, some profane form of hallelujah, until the Book of Fragments became like Mao's Book of Quotations or Poor Richard's Almanac, a collection of aphorisms. Talbot had explained that what they were composing would be a sutra, the Talbot Sutra, like the golden verses of Pythagoras or the biblical Ecclesiastes. It would serve as the new consciousness, a modern Mein Kampf, as it were. They would publish it, samizdat, like the Soviet dissidents, in the manner of Andrei Sakharov, and distribute the copies via the growing network of Clems and Dawsons and Charlies snaking man by man across the nation. And still certain that somehow this would make him a rich man. This would win him Shasta's heart. Walter had written everything down. Because of the yelling, the police show up. Because it's after midnight and Bing was a chieftain of the first lineage, this meant helicopters circling the neighborhood and sweeping the area with searchlights. Because the police are forever and everywhere after the same deal. Did you fight? Did he fight you? Because Felix's ma shakes her head down because she figures this is somehow her doing. Because then Delicious walks in the door going, "Belle, what's your Felix gone and done now?" Because Delicious doesn't know it's her ass at stake too. Because it's everyone's butt on the line. Because if the truth comes out, then Belle and Delicious, Jarvis and Gentry will go into detention as suspect detainees forever. Because nobody prioritizes accepting damaged goods. Because the newly declared homosexuals of Caucasia and Blacktopia being held in detention elsewhere are good for a 500,000 Talbots or a new fresh somebody. So why settle for some traitor whom even Geisha wants rid of? Because the paramedics are debriding the cuts and scratches on his face and neck. Because Felix looks almost as beat up as the dead body of Bing. Because folks leaning out their bedroom windows heard Bing's last words clear and distinct. Because people live in the forever after shadow of that Kitty Genovese, the lesbian who was strangled and stabbed and strangled and stabbed while some entire city full of onlookers failed to take action. Because so many people leaned out windows back then and never called the police because a young, pretty lesbian getting herself butchered wasn't their problem. Because of that, everyone chimes in reciting Bing's yelled out last words. To hear Felix tell it, he and Bing had been peacefully smoking dope in the alley around midnight. In the version he told the investigating officers, Bing had been telling stories about the success of his lineage, and how he, Bing himself, had journeyed to a basement in Portland, Oregon, and had an audience in the presence of the venerable Talbot. Bing hadn't been a nobody. As a chieftain of the first lineage, his death called for a massive investigation. Dogs had been dispatched to track possible traces of Bing's blood on an escaping killer. Even as the paramedics debrided the cuts and scratches on Felix's face and neck, he told them what he wanted to tell. Because no one except Felix had paid much attention to Bing as of late. Because frankly, Bing's one-day war story could be a bore. And because people had more to fret about, what with sperm drives and biological carrier commissions. Because people would never say as much, but they were beginning to question the greatness of Geysia, the gay promised land, and because they missed the kick-up-your-heels lifestyle they'd lived under heterosexual oppression. It's because of this guilt. Guilt over doubting Geysia, guilt over Kitty Genovese, that all the ear witnesses repeated Bing's last gasped words. It's because of them Felix said what he finally said. Because he didn't say it at first, not right away. Because he knew it would trigger an international incident. Because he didn't want this nation, Geysia, to be at war. Because wasn't Adjustment Day about saving a generation from military cemeteries? Because why should statesmen get to snuff out the lives of men barely able to vote? But because Felix doesn't want to see his folks internment camped, and because he needs to buy time because any simple DNA test will prove it's his DNA and only his DNA grabbed all over Bing's corpse and clawed under Bing's fingernails, because everyone's baying for blood and justice. Felix says it was a gang of strangers. Because it's plausible. And because this gains him traction. Because Felix was quickly replacing Talbot on every channel, the satellite relayed image of him. Because he had all of Geysia hanging on his every word. Because he was already packing a getaway bag in his mind, packing his favorite shirts and an extra pair of shoes. And because Felix needed that crucial head start to make his escape. That's the reason Felix finally said what he did. "Straights," he told the television cameras. "Straight guys bashed him." It never failed to leave Shasta astounded. The same sun that warmed her neck at this moment had also warmed Hitler's. The stars she could see from her marriage bed were the stars that had twinkled above infamous Nazi death camps. How humans organized their society and conducted their lives counted for nothing in the grand scheme. Trees were taking root on the burial pits. The important parts of life remained a constant. People fed their children. People could only truly hate those who lived next door. Just as life had been before, everyone was preoccupied by staying alive. Water always found a new level, a new normal. The field wives, for example, they roamed the thriving rows of kale and squash, each woman swollen with a child, all of them Charlie's offspring. Soon every day would be marked by the birth of one or more heirs. In another year, the estate would be overrun with tiny Charlies. One real possibility was that Shasta herself was the problem, the party pooper, as it were. If she'd been born into this moment, she'd see only peaceful women doing useful work to the sound of mandolins. Well-fed, they were all healthy and plump with their future children. If she hadn't known the world before Adjustment Day, she wouldn't see this Edenic scene through such a cynical, bitter lens. These future children would accept this life as a given. The idea both comforted and enraged her. As they labored over the weeding chores, Shasta went about her usual search among the roots and furrows. The sun warmed the hooded cowl she wore, edged with decadent fake ocelot fur. A band of roving minstrels plucked lutes and crooned ballads. A wave of nausea surged up from her belly, and she fought the urge to puke on a row of maturing parsnips. She could be. Heaven knows Charlie had sown plenty of seed in her. She shuddered at the possibility of becoming another broodmare for the rapacious chieftain. A meek figure shuffled forward. The girl didn't speak, but stopped an arm's length away. A lacy cap held the long hair gathered atop her head. A light veil of netting cascaded over her face to protect her young complexion from the sun. Her humble, downcast gaze remained on her own rustic wooden clogs. The girl reached into a pocket of her apron. She withdrew a wad of soft cloth, a tiny bundle of joy, a swaddled treasure. Wound around it, a strand of carefully knotted string kept it closed. She looked furtively from side to side. The other field wives seemed frozen in the moment. A woman in the near distance nodded slowly, once. Seeing that signal, the girl offered the bundle of fabric. Her eyes met Shasta's for an instant. Shasta reached to accept the gift, and something caught her focus. The girl wore long sleeves. Long skirts and long sleeves were the rule. But at the cuff of the sleeve, a smooth patch of her wrist showed. A bold, blue-black symbol stood out against the pale skin. A thorny uppercase letter R. Before accepting the gift, Shasta plucked at the sleeve. When the girl didn't pull away, Shasta slid the sleeve up to reveal an I and an O. Inked across the inside of the forearm, from her hand to the crook of her elbow, were the words, Riot Girl. This modest lass, with her cringing demeanor, not long ago, she'd been a badass bitch goddess. This timid waif, her belly made huge by Charlie's deeds, she'd been a kick-ass roller derby warrior. Now Shasta surveyed the fields with new understanding. These women had all been bike messengers and basketball stars. Today they were hunched field wenches doomed to imminent repetitive motherhood. But not a year before, they'd been drummers in rock bands. They'd been dope-smoking firewalkers and hairless pole dancers. How long ago had Adjustment Day occurred? Without cell phones or calendars, it was impossible to track the days. Only the weather suggested time passing. Shasta let the girl's sleeve drop back into place, hiding the evidence of her former self. The girl gently placed the tiny bundle in Shasta's hand and shuffled away quickly. Behind her, another young woman waited to present yet another bundle of fabric. Most likely, word had gotten around among the womenfolk. Most knew what prize Shasta hunted. Behind her, a third woman waited to give Shasta her own fragile tribute, wrapped just so for safekeeping. Checking the typeset pages for the book, Walter had marveled. This book, combined with the internet gimmick of the list, it was a drug. As the author himself had put it, a good book should get you high. It read like pornography. What his new old man had dictated to him amounted to a pornography of power. Walter had known the formula. The biggest bestsellers in history had been targeted at children and young adults. People who had no power. They were starved for stories depicting similar kids attaining an ultimate power. From Harry Potter to Superman to Luke Skywalker to Robin the Boy Wonder, it would seem that all kids wanted to develop their own latent superpowers and see their parents dead. The Talbot book delivered on both counts. The unemployed and underemployed steam fitters and press operators would see themselves slay their oppressors and then rise to rule their own fiefdoms. It amounted to a pornography of being right. No orgasm would be as satisfying as proving everyone else wrong. No sexual content could compete with the rush men got from winning. And the Talbot book was about nothing if it wasn't about winning. Talbot, the old coot, he knew what men craved most. As he perused the book, Walter had taken Shasta's earplug from the pocket of his shirt. He'd held it to his nose and inhaled. This talisman, something a witch might use to summon up the dead. Spongy, titty pink, it was an artifact coated with her dead skin and internal secretions, this relic dug out of the side of her head. His nose could convince the rest of him that Shasta was sitting here beside him. Shasta, he'd known. She'd hate the book. She might groove on the prescribed Renaissance fair threads and resurrected faux Nordic culture. She did have her tattoo. Across her chest, it read, "Mit einem Schwert in deinem Erzensterben." Whatever that meant. She'd dig the proposed medieval castle lifestyle and still hate the book. But she'd love the money it would bring them. Shasta would take one look at the world it proposed, and she'd toss the book into the trash. Well, not the trash. Shasta would toss it into the recycling. After that, right after that, she'd call up Beyonce and fly on some private jet to go shoe shopping on Bond Street in London, with Madonna, and Walter's credit card. A curtain separated them, akin to a stage curtain. A pale sheet of muslin did hang from the ceiling of the chamber with the royal physician and a sizable contingent of the court facing it. An odd 100 or so grooms, squires, valets. Something unseen on the opposite side stirred the fabric, and Physician Terence bade, "If your highness will do us the honor of presenting himself." To date, royal protocol remained at best semi-solid. Thus the best strategy, lest the physician give offense, was to hew to a mood of lofty white-speak formality. As now he sat upon a carved wooden footstool, he reached forward and with his fingers poked at the curtain until he found a hole therein. He wiggled an index finger within the hole. "Simply display the royal scepter." Fancy work of silk embroidery did edge the hole. The assembled company eyed the hole and waited. Terence withdrew his fingers and waited. To put his royal patient at ease, he recollected his own miraculous healing, how he'd been a bedridden invalid since infancy, how a merciful hospital nurse had delivered to him a copy of the Talbot book on behalf of his absent father. With his father's marginalia as encouragement, Terence had overcome his domineering mother, a woman whose entrancing words could prompt him to violent seizures. Facing the curtain, he did recount the epic tug of war over his catheter, and how the struggle brought his mother crashing to the floor, how the Talbot book itself had struck the knockout punch and broken her nose. Broken the nose so that it would forever lie sideways against her cheek. Of the catheter had ripped free. Intense had been the pain, but his tackle remained intact. Foiled had been any attempt at castration. Terence's fingers prodded impatiently at the embroidered hole. Still, nothing emerged from the opposite side. Of chief concern this day was the large numbers of sexual contacts Chieftain Charlie had enjoyed as of late. More specifically, whether one of said encounters might have communicated a social disease to His Highness. As the physician understood the situation, His Highness had grown concerned over certain physical changes of an intimate nature. Nonetheless, there was little that could be done without an inspection. "Of greatest importance is that we determine a prognosis," said Terence. Here he quoted the blue-black book. "The way of man is not to hope, but to take action and produce results." At this, the muslin finally stirred. Bulge did it, and the embroidered edges of the small hole began to spread apart. With an upraised hand, the physician forbid any man's utterance, as something wan and shriveled made its timid entrance among them. The next morning, when she brought the breakfast tray, Arabella was transformed. As far back as Miss Jo could recollect, the housekeeper had been a hunchback old frump. In recent years, there had been something increasingly clownish in the defeated way the woman had plodded around the house. A fringe benefit of keeping help was how waxing floors and polishing silver wore them out. For the same reason brides choose ugly bridesmaids for a wedding, having the housekeeper around made Miss Jo look remarkably well-preserved. Until this morning, that is. This Arabella was a stranger. Her knotted limbs had grown slender and supple. In place of her staid uniform, she wore a flowing gown. A dashiki, Miss Jo dredged up the word. The garment moved like water over the woman's smooth skin, the material accented with radiant emeralds embedded in its weave. The frizzed mop of her gray hair had been changed into a lustrous mane of long auburn curls. Her cracked hands and face gleamed so bright with reflected light that they looked wet with perfumed oils. Those lovely hands bore the tray. Two poached eggs, a ham steak, an English muffin with butter and marmalade on the side. "Miss Josephine," she said in a voice as new as her appearance, "Mr. Jamal asked me to convey his apologies." This voice resonated with an elegant depth, a velvet rumble. "Affairs of state required that he depart late last evening." She was so lovely that Miss Jo's first impulse was to discharge her. But this was no longer Miss Jo's house, and Arabella was no longer in her employ. The housekeeper was so lovely that Miss Jo could only look away in pained resentment. Catching sight of her own reflection in a silver teaspoon, she felt her stomach shrivel. She'd stained and poisoned herself into this gambling, sinister elf. Doing so, yes, she'd cemented her position in this new nation-state. But at what cost? Clearly, she no longer belonged here. Pretending to be engrossed in buttering her muffin, she remarked,
"Arabella, that frock is extremely flattering to a woman of your size."
Arabella laughed softly in her new throaty tones.
"It's not the ensemble," she said. "It's the transformation of my people."
She described how white men had always belittled African blacks for never inventing the wheel or the plow. The truth was that Africans had disdained any tools that disfigured the earth. Blacks had an alliance with the earth that stretched back through all time. Any request, the planet granted. That had made the continent so rich in resources. The land enjoyed incubating gold and diamonds within its womb to delight the black humans. And the humans, in turn, would never scar the land with roads or plowed furrows.
"When the white man entered Africa," Arabella continued, "we expected him to have the same respect for the sacred land. But because this soil was not his cradle, the European had recognized nothing except the wealth he wanted to plunder. A man who'd never approve of abortion, a man who professed to sanctify life, he tore open the womb of the earth and ripped out the gifts that had been prepared and harbored there. White oil wells and pit mines gutted the land, and what the planet had produced to reward the stewardship of the black race, the white man looted and spirited away." Arabella regarded Miss Jo with a cool, disdainful look.
"Since that time, my people have learned to keep our special powers concealed. Going back hundreds of years, we've hidden our true talents and wisdom out of the fear that the white man would abuse those as well, to increase his hoard of acquisitions."
Miss Jo looked at her hands, chemically discolored, and felt a deep shame for the history of her greedy race. She felt humiliated by her own burnt hair. Without question, the white man's folly and guilt had been bequeathed to her.
"Of all people, only Mr. King came close to exposing the true magic of black people," Arabella explained. For many years, we debated killing him for our own protection. Miss Josephine listened in amazement. Blacks killed Martin Luther King Jr.?
Arabella scowled.
Not Dr. King, she exclaimed. We hired a man to kill Stephen King. Unfortunately, the assassin was inept, and the intended hit and run was a failure.
In the author's masterpiece novel, she said, books such as The Shining and The Stand and The Green Mile, King had almost convinced white people of the majestic, uncanny powers blacks kept under wraps. Without prompting, Arabella shook out the linen napkin and tucked it into the neckline of Miss Jo's housecoat. The housekeeper lifted the knife and cut a small square from the ham steak. With the fork, she carefully placed the morsel into the old woman's mouth.
Now eat, she said. Speechless, Miss Jo mutely chewed that same bite of ham over and over, like a cow with its cud, unaware as the meat was reduced to a tasteless mush. Silence and expectation bore down upon her. Finally, she ventured,
So, where was the fire? Why'd Jamal fly out of here in such a hurry last night?
In response, Arabella stepped to the room's small television and touched a button. The screen filled with tiny people, a torch-bearing mob.
You know that boy is holding his own secrets, the housekeeper said, watching the crowded screen. You've seen the way he studies those old paintings of your ancestors.
On television, an ocean of rioters surrounded a stately building, throwing rocks and bricks against its carved facade. Gunshots rang out, and puffs of dust showed where bullets ricocheted off the stone. There was the bright sound of glass breaking. A closer shot revealed the tall, ornate windows. They framed the faces of people trapped within. Handsome and beautiful, but trapped nonetheless. All those faces were black. Talbot's intuition had been spot on. The 1960s had torn down all the patterns for living. Since then, generations had wandered through their lives in search of a new shared blueprint. The answer wasn't communism or fascism, nor was it Christianity or capitalism. Political activism and education were both revealed to be corrupt. The greatest accomplishment of modern man had been to do away with those constraining models.
The only quality that truly unites us is our desire to be united, he'd always insisted. What men want is a structure for communion.
Until recently, our circumstances had drawn us together and kept us united. Our shared proximity as next-door neighbors, as co-workers at our jobs and congregants in our churches, as classmates in school. All of these structures brought people into community with regularity. But as people began to move households so frequently, when jobs became less stable and churches became less relevant, we'd lost reliable contact with each other. As Talbot saw it, race and sexual preference had to become the last bastion for community. As all the grand uniting narratives floundered, when all the tenuous external circumstances failed us, we'd be forced to form our ranks based on our most basic elements, skin color and sexual desire. Walter had seen it. Clearly, his new old man intended the book as a vehicle for making Walter's fortune. The men, those Jamals and Estebans, they were the foot soldiers, the advance guard opening the market for the book's wider introduction. Those rubes and preppers. Here were faux profound thoughts to replace the slogans that advertising had planted in people's heads. According to Talbot, only consumption remained as a means of self-expression. That's why men's only response to beauty was to consume it. Thus, beauty became pornography so it could be consumed. Status was measured by levels and quality of consumption.
of people's time, of their energies. Cannibalism couldn't be far behind. What's more, as the Talbot Book decreed, suicide is the ultimate act of consumption, and by extension, civilization is consuming itself. That had been his explanation for why Western civilizations were dwindling. Citizens of the white diaspora were consuming themselves with drugs, blacks with violence, homosexuals with disease. In their tapestry-lined honeymoon chamber, Shasta found her new husband hurriedly folding hosen and surcoats. He stepped to the gargantuan wardrobe cabinet and stripped the dry-cleaning plastic off a houppelande of rich royal blue velvet, accented with scuttled piping. A suitcase lay open across the foot of their enormous canopy bed, half-filled with kilts and tabards. Charlie packed his favorite codpiece among them. When Shasta went to embrace him, he shook her off, saying, "Not right now." His tone was gruff. "A council of chieftains has been called to assemble." A gondolier had been hired to pole the royal barge down the Columbia River to the ruins of Portland. There, the lineage would gather in a lofty boardroom perched atop one of the remaining high-rises in the abandoned downtown core. Rumor had it that Portland had long ago outstripped its at-home bathtub production of tempeh. Their stores of soy exhausted, the denizens had taken to devouring each other. The tranquil garden city now stank like an open grave. This journey would hold no appeal for any of the chieftains who'd been summoned. Undeterred, Shasta approached him once more, and she lightly fingered his merkin. The tension in his body relented. She dropped to her knees, deftly stripping aside his scabbard and unlacing his Venetian breeches. Her hands discovered his flaccid pride and commenced their kneading. With a jarring wince, Charlie cried, "Ouch!" Shasta's fingers continued, more gently. "Watch it," he protested, his voice weaker, faint, carried away by the pleasure of her touch. Shasta's mouth joined forces with her hands in their wifely duties. The nausea stirred in her belly. Despite her voluminous organza skirts, the stone floor hurt her kneecaps. His head lolling, Charlie whined, "I felt something." Her mouth paused in its task so she might draw a breath. "No, duh. I'd hope so." She quelled the bitchiness in her voice. "I am honoring your highness." He moaned, but his words failed. "But Geisha, the people of Geisha have overrun our embassy and taken our diplomats hostage." Muttering, slurring his words, delirious with sensation, her husband went on to announce that Geisha had declared war against both Caucasia and Blacktopia. The news caught Shasta off guard and she gagged an instant. Her gorge rose, threatening to scald the royal manhood with bilious digestive acids. A fine going-away gift that would make. Only with great effort was she able to choke down both. And one afternoon, when Walter had been idly leafing through a copy of the newly printed Talbot book, the old man had looked up. Walter's new old man, he'd glared, his brow furrowed and demanded, "What's that you're reading?" Walter held up the book, showing its blue-black cover and the gilded title. Talbot snarled, "What's it called?" Walter ran a fingertip under the title. "Adjustment Day." The old man's face flushed so red that fresh blood spurted from two small cuts on his forehead.
"That's not..."
Walter turned the book and read the title. That was it. Adjustment Day. Sputtering, saliva flying.
"That's not what I said!"
bellowed the old man. A chill ran through Walter. His head did the grim math. How many books had been printed and already distributed? Answer, all of them. Talbot said,
"You idiot! Stop the presses!"
It was too late, but Walter didn't say that.
"I told you to call the book A Judgment Day,"
Talbot ranted. A judgment day? God only knew what else Walter had misheard. Talbot shook his head in disbelief. He snapped,
"Is it too late to fix this? Typographical error."
A judgment day. Duh. And Walter lied. He put on his best look of sincere confidence and he told the old man, "Don't worry, I'll fix it." Closing the Talbot book and carefully setting it aside, the speaker proclaimed,
"Queer bodies have always been the shock troops in Western civilization."
A general grumble rose from the audience seated around Gavin. They'd been hearing this lecture since they'd relinquished themselves to the retention center. It would hit on the same points, Malcolm X being a bisexual hustler, James Baldwin, the feminist movement, and their own Night of the Long Knives, where they'd ousted their founding lesbian contingent in order to make the movement more appealing to soccer moms. The speech would touch on urban renewal, and the climax would be how Hitler's schoolboy crush on Ludwig Wittgenstein had set in motion World War II and the infamous Final Solution. Every month or so, a chieftain from Geisha arrived to deliver these pep talks to boost morale. Today's speaker was a chieftain of the first lineage, a man named Esteban. He raised his voice in response to the grumbling. Interrupting, Gavin said,
"My sister?"
The room quieted.
"My sister, Charm, did the math, and she says none of us are getting traded until we're almost 40.
He wasn't loud, but the silence was so absolute that his voice sounded huge. Another kid yelled,
"What's up with that?"
The speaker countered,
"Female immigrants will be granted first priority so they can begin the production of exports as quickly as possible."
The young lesbian seated around Gavin groaned. The camp didn't look so grim when compared to a career as human breeding stock. From the podium, Esteban stressed,
"That should expedite the exchange process by a number of years."
The Gaysian stance. Their official platform was that neither Caucasia nor Blacktopia wanted to feed and house exports any longer than was absolutely necessary. As time passed, special accommodations would be made to exchange exports as quickly as possible. A trade agreement might be reached that would allow current Gaysian exports to immigrate in exchange for future immigrants from Geisha. That's the reason the pipeline had to be as burdened as possible. The reality was that Gavin and his generation, the first generation to reach the age of declaration since Adjustment Day, was sorting trash for recycling. They were imprisoned, sleeping in dormitories, eating ramen noodles 3 times daily with no distraction other than separating number 6 plastics from number 8 plastics and 10 from aluminum, a task that used to be done by machine before slave labor became more cost-effective. Except that it wasn't called slave labor, it was called outsourcing. It was offshore labor, except that it wasn't offshore. It was located smack dab in Caucasia. And the workers weren't slaves, except for the fact that they couldn't leave the campus. Except the campus was hemmed in with barbed wire and guard towers. And it was noble, rewarding work to benefit their future and the future of Geisha. Except they spent every day slouched over a crawling-by conveyor belt loaded with sticky tin cans and soiled paper under a constant swarm of black flies attracted by the stink of decomposing yogurt and stale beer. None of the exports had lived here longer than a year. Except every week felt like a year. Except no one had a calendar because no one had expected to be stuck here that long. Except some realists,
who'd begun to scratch hash marks in the paint in one bathroom stall so everyone could go and count the days at any time and be appalled by how long they'd actually been bivouacked here, picking through the garbage. Except it made no difference because they were still trapped. Except every month, somebody official from the promised land they'd never reach arrived to raise their spirits with a rousing speech about the glory of Geysia. Except today, when Gavin stood up in the middle of the speech, in the middle of the audience, and asked the horrible question. He asked, "Is my generation condemned here for life?" Charm had suggested as much. She'd written, speculating that no one would be traded until the first child in Geysia turned 18. Not in any sizable numbers. Yes, there were some children in Geysia, but not in numbers that mattered. And even then, Charm predicted that younger exports would be given preference, just as women were being given preference, and that Caucasia was more than sustaining its own population, and that the more exports it produced, the more cheap slave labor it could maintain in retention camps. Because frankly, heterosexuals were just better at reproduction, and they had a longer cultural history of making babies, and the future would be reduced to a constant export-making race between the nations. Gavin didn't want to be rude. No one held a greater respect for the chieftains of Geysia, except Gavin wanted the truth, except he wanted it spoken in front of everyone. Except he didn't want to be the messenger of bad news. Except none of them was getting any younger. "Sir?" asked Gavin, wanting to show some respect and not just be a nag. "Will we ever see our homeland?" The question elicited a scattered outburst of applause. Except Gavin wasn't trying to dump all over this Esteban, who was the kind of good-looking where if he smiled at you, you'd have to smile back. Except you didn't know what he was like as a person except how hot. Except this brought Charm to mind, and the last time they played the game of Mine Yours, where they'd point out random people as potential sex partners and shout, "Mine or yours." Like the game Slugbug, where you tried to slam your opponent by surprise. Except the last time they were in Laurelhurst Park, Gavin pointed out the Skag King pushing a shopping cart loaded with prescriptions. Nick, his name was, with the crystal meth cheekbones and sun-bleached hair. And Gavin yelled, "Yours!" Except then Charm pointed out a guy, the doppelganger for the cute one of the Thompson twins with the rat-tail haircut, with the henna and the skin the color of powder, except without the baggy 1980s gear. Except then, Gavin got confused. Except when he realized Charm was playing by different rules. It's because she actually wanted the best for him. Except she didn't realize he'd been trying to slam her, and it's because she really actually did have the hots for that crystal meth Nick guy. He'd been trying to irk and embarrass her. Except all she wanted for him was happiness with a Thompson twins lookalike. Except that's what made it scary when she wrote with her theory about him probably never immigrating. It's because she wasn't his sibling rival. She was telling the truth. Except Esteban redirected, saying how history had a model, saying homosexuals had always lived walled inside monasteries and convents where they'd preserved the knowledge of the ancient world and compiled the secrets of the natural world, hybridizing sweet peas and making sure the Dark Ages would not eradicate the legacy of man's civilization. Except Gavin was not thrilled by the prospect of watching peas have sex. Not while his prime, hot, porn-ready 18-year-old body was picking trash. And he was going to say as much when an administrator stepped up to the podium and implied to Esteban that he had an important phone call backstage. And when Esteban ducked out to get it, the administrator leaned into the microphone and announced Gavin's name, not in a good voice, and said Gavin was to go to the front office where he had a guest waiting. Gavin went to the reception area, and there was a girl with so many tattoos he had to wonder if her boyfriends lay in bed after sex and read her body like the back of a box of cereal. Right then, a skinny old man with flapping arm skin, his skin shining with dried blood. A naked, bloody old man walked across the far side of the room. A stinky, naked old man, his chest and back oozing with countless tiny wounds. Gavin couldn't help himself. He did an ick-induced full-body shudder and a cringing dance as if he'd stepped through a big spider web. The man wasn't Nick, but he was close enough. Gavin looked at his sister and said, "Yours." Hardly had Charlie glimpsed his own manhood in recent days, so constantly buried was it in one or another of Shasta's moist orifices. Hidden and labored was it by her, until he was grateful to fate that Shasta was his final wife rather than his first. Any day the wives of his fields and household would begin to push forth his children. They would pop with the ferocity and frequency of popcorn. Many had he blessed within minutes of one another. Their fruiting would occur with the same relentless speed and repetition with which he'd sown his lordly seeds. Among these women were many not happy to be in service beneath him. In no female except Shasta had his manhood met its match. In her wet embrace, he had spent himself too oft. Like an insatiable succubus was she, leaving him so flaccid, almost numb, yet were his exhausted testes hypersensitive to every jolt of his carriage wheels. It had come at an inopportune juncture, this calling of the chieftain's council. If Shasta yet was without a belly child, that task was beyond his doing to perform. Although intuition and hope hinted otherwise, green was her complexion as of late, and several times did she take flight from her morning repast to hurl chunks in the palace crapper. If kingly wisdom served, Charlie had planted within her loins an heir. Had Charlie a great sacrifice to Thor offered? A plentitude of sweet rutabagas and savory gorse was it, in such abundance as to satiate the god. At present, as he and his party approached the silent city, was the chieftain greatly glad he had acquired the goodwill of Odin and Loki. For the deserted township of Portland amounted to naught but a dense forest on its outskirts. The passing months had allowed the vegetation to amass itself, consolidating an impenetrable jungle of flowering buddleia, this woven with tendrils of stout privet, this shot through with a suffocating blanket of juniper tams. These neglected suburbs constituted a formidable barrier. No lesser army of stout swordsmen could have hacked a path through this matted wall of hybrid tea roses and untamed lilacs. Any company smaller than Charlie's would have been swallowed up by the onslaught of pyramidal arborvitae. Nor was vegetation their sole concern. The demented natives did pose a constant threat, as demonstrated by a darting figure, a stalking puppet, a skeletal old man clothed in naught but a sheen of dried blood. This specter, lanced with wounds uncountable, dashed within sight of the royal company for an instant. It shouted, "Walter!" and was instantly gone. Vanished deep into the dense sedge. Satisfactory time had passed that the city was deemed safe. Safe enough. Most stragglers had eaten each other, and the survivors would be weak and few. As the royal processional labored to clear a path, faint strains of melody reached them. Unseen was a player crafting a tune on some stringed instrument. The captain of the guard called for silence, and the woodsmen and knights stilled their hacking. None but the songbirds disturbed the deadly calm of that ghost town. The music grew in volume, its source coming near, until at last, a figure stepped into view. Emerging from the thicket of death and desolation was a man. Little more than a skeleton. His leathery limbs wore tattered rags. This ragamuffin, his face appeared lost behind a robust beard and the shroud of his long hair. The man held a guitar in his arms and strummed it. So absorbed in his music-making was he that he'd stepped amidst the royal entourage before stopping in his tracks. Minus his song, only the birds broke the silence. Reclining in his carriage was Charlie, captivated by the stranger's tunefulness. The chieftain had grown weary of the usual mincing jugglers and yodelers.
"Here! Vagabond!"
he bid from the vehicle's velvet-cushioned interior.
"Belong you to a house and master?"
The wastrel glanced up from his guitar. He made no answer, the impertinent varlet, but commenced once more to softly stroke his instrument. An axeman in the chieftain's company lifted his blade in subtle threat.
"Answer, you!"
He reared back, ready to lop off the man's shaggy head.
"And answer ye and none but the approved white speak of Caucasia!"
Charlie did call again.
"Well, men, are you free to become my slave?"
The tosspot ceased his music-making.
"Who is it would be my master?" he sneered.
Another in the party, the royal physician, spoke up.
"You unschooled groundling! This is none other than Charlie, chieftain of the first lineage, husband of the beautiful Queen Shasta, and liberator of Caucasia!"
Hearing such praise, Charlie lifted his chin, and his chest swelled with pride. To display his valuable Nagahide gloves, he lifted a hand as if to straighten his weighty gold crown. The musician's scowl dissolved. His face went slack with amazement, and he drew a long breath. He stammered,
"My lord, you are not unknown to me."
Collecting himself, he placed an open hand over his heart and bowed his head in respect. Looking up, he asked,
"Your noble wife, perchance, is she Shasta Sanchez, formerly of Southeast Lincoln Street, who attended Franklin High School, worked part-time at Starbucks, and played goalie in City League soccer?"
Silence seized all present. Charlie sensed a threat. A rival, perhaps. Warily, he asked,
"Know you the shapely lass in question?"
The stranger waved away the idea.
"No, my lord. Her renown is such that all hereabouts know her legend."
He set aside his guitar and doffed his ragged stocking hat.
"We take great pride that a maiden from our humble township should become a queen of the white peoples."
The statement prompted even more pride within Charlie's breast. Hearing such praise, he took an immediate liking to the man.
"Do you know this place?"
He gestured about at the rotting condominiums and tumble-down freeway overpasses. He asked,
"Can you guide us through this morass of thorns, as to avoid any bands of highwaymen who yet remain in this godforsaken place?"
The physician, Terence, inquired,
"How are you called, peasant?"
The man turned disdainful eyes on the asker.
"My name," growled he. "You may call me Nick."
The stranger folded his arms and rolled his eyes as if weighing the proposal to serve as their guide. He cocked his head. He wet the pad of a soiled finger against his tongue and held it up as if to check the speed and direction of the wind. Next, he knelt and pressed one filthy ear to the cracked concrete as if listening for the approach of horsemen. Only after all the preceding did he narrow his eyes and ask,
"To where is your highness journeying?"
A mounted cavalier among them called back,
"The terminal sales building."
From another steed, a second cavalier shouted lustily,
"To the highest conference room of the same! There a gathering of all the chieftains shall take place."
Charlie held up a Nagahide gloved hand to silence them. Of the grimy musician, he asked,
"Know it, you?"
Making no wordy reply, The man retrieved his guitar from the ground. He started away on foot down a shadowy avenue that none among Charlie's attendants had taken note of. He waved for them to follow, and after a moment's hesitation, the mighty horses leaned into their traces, and the great wheels of the royal carriage creaked and turned, and attendants numbering in the hundreds commenced to march forward in the stranger's wake. Esteban listened to the voice over the phone. He knew that history would eventually erase them, but he'd never suspected it would be this soon. The Talbot book had readied them to die. It had lifted them from addiction and resignation. It had given them control of their world and their own lives. Now, at what ought to be the time of their rejoicing, Bing was gone. Esteban relinquished the phone to the clerk in charge. He excused himself to go to the bathroom. Seated in a stall, he discovered hash marks scratched in the paint. He counted 374 marks. In Geisha, Delicious had her feet in stirrups, but her mind had wandered miles away. Wondering, would Gentry still love her? Pondering, had it been worth this trial, hiding in a country where she did not belong? A voice snapped her back to the here and now. She lay back on an examining table with her legs in the air. Curtains divided them from innumerable such booths stretching away on either side. A masked figure stood between her knees. A surgical cap hid the technician's hair, but her eyes were bloodshot and sunken in exhausted pits of baggy, discolored skin. "There. Now rest," she said, holding a dripping pipette in one latex-gloved hand. The technician swabbed the pipette with a wipe smelling of alcohol. In a distracted tone, she said, "Thank you for your service." A nation's first generation is no small feat. Delicious was the nest to a cuckoo's egg. She was the cuckold, compelled to raise a stranger's child, the enemy's child, as the enemy would be raising one for her, figuratively speaking. Her new nation teetered on the brink of World War III. And so that Geisha would hold as many hostages as possible, every woman of childbearing age had been called up for mandatory insemination. Domestic industries had been retooled for the maximum production of wartime sperm. In the facility, the curtains fluttered as a drag queen in a sequin-spangled nurse's getup entered carrying a metal tray crowded with tiny paper cups. Delicious took one and gulped down a mouthful of watery orange juice while the drag queen sang, "The seed inside you, I can see it growing," from the Paul Anka hit, "Having My Baby." The drag disappeared into the next cubicle, and Delicious heard the song start up again. The technician, who was herself extremely pregnant under her scrubs, set aside her instruments and struggled to help Delicious off the table. Once she was on her feet, a smock was offered, and Delicious slipped her arms into the sleeves. From a nearby cubicle came, "Thank you for your service." The technician, pulling a fresh sheet of sterile paper to cover the table, said, "We recommend you lie down in the recovery area to guarantee results." "Thank you for your service," said a man's voice in the distance. Delicious told herself, another angel got its wings, and suppressed a laugh. To keep up appearances, Bell had brought her and was waiting in the reception area. The clinic itself had once been an airport. In a few weeks, Delicious would return the favor and escort Bell back here for the same treatment. The Dixie cup of orange juice, the snippet of Paul Anka. The smock amounted to a military uniform. Delicious told herself, "Those also serve who only sit and wait with their legs in the air," and choked back a hysterical giggle. The streets and shops were filled with women wearing the same flower sack. Roomy. It was designed to be worn through giving birth, subjecting the wearer to endless rounds of being thanked by strangers. They rode home in a cab, an extravagance,
At their destination, the driver refused to accept payment. He began, "Thank you for..." But Delicious averted her face and raised an open hand to interrupt him. From the entrance to the alleyway beside their building, a mass of candles and teddy bears spilled out onto the street. Bouquets of carnations filled the air with the sweetness of rot. Hand-lettered and heart-shaped sympathy cards read, "Bing" and "Our Hero." A queue of mourners stretched down the block, each waiting his or her turn to deposit a bouquet of roses or a fluttering, flashing bunch of Mylar balloons in rainbow colors. A crew of television news people panned the crowd with their lights. A man with a microphone walked the line asking how the assassination had affected people. A few wept openly. The newscaster turned to address the camera, saying, "Police have located security footage of the killing. They've announced that an arrest is imminent." The two women hurried from the cab, keys in hand, to the building's doorway. Behind them, a chorus of voices shouted, "Thank you for..." The elevator doors pinched off the final words. Safely inside the apartment, with the bolt thrown and the chain on, Belle called, "We're home!" When no one responded, she called, "Felix?" The television was on. As always, Talbot filled the screen. He told them, "The world wants a unified field theory. A thing. One thing that explains everything. Give it to them." Delicious stood in the living room as Belle stepped to her son's door and knocked. On television, Talbot said, "The measure of a man is not what he does for wages, but what he does with his free time." When Belle reappeared, she was carrying a sheet of paper. From it she read, "Dear Mom," and looked at Delicious with brimming eyes. Canada was a test. Long after sunset, Dawson drove the back roads of what used to be Idaho. After the fugitive, Ramantha, had fallen asleep, he turned down a rutted dirt lane, crowded by briars on both sides. No moon had risen. He followed his headlights into the dark until he could see a fence blocking their path. A gate stood in the center with no sign. Its distance was just as far as he could make out with his high beams. Dawson reached over and nudged the woman. "We're here." She jolted awake, peered into the night around them. "We're at the border," he told her. God only knew what the gate led to. Some estate where she'd be taken prisoner and executed in accord with the new laws. Or was there some back pasture where the wolves would chase her down? Either way, she'd be dead. They weren't anywhere near Canada. But she'd no longer be his problem. He shut off the engine, but kept the headlights on. He looked around as if to check for border patrols. She squinted through the streaked windshield and asked, "Through that gate?" He nodded. "Hurry." The words of Talbot whispered from the truck's radio. "The way of a man is not to hope, but to take action and to produce results." She kept her eyes on the distant gate as her hands checked her pockets. Dawson felt the wedding ring stuffed in his own pants pocket.